Colonel Evans Loam, Reel 3. Colonel, did you have any changes in your tactical exercises when you got your equipment?
No. The tanks we used in the same way as cavalry, in that you had a fire point which you maneuvered round one flank or the other. And when we had the tanks, we did the same thing. And immediately before the war, we were issued with 2-pounder guns, which was supposed to be a great asset to the tanks. And they certainly fired with a very straight trajectory. But as it turned out in the war later on, a 2-pounder gun was a ridiculous thing.
Did you do sort of gunnery training with that 2-pounder?
No, not particularly, because it was such a flat trajectory firing instrument, and you didn't fire at long ranges.
What would be your sort of, if you like, typical sort of day when you'd first got the equipment in terms of the training program? Did you do individual training programs?
Oh, yes. Well, we received our, in the first place, Ford V8 cars by squadrons. And so one squadron started mechanized training while the others went on with the horses for some months. And in fact, I was the last squadron with horses, and so the last to train. And our horses were taken and sent to India, the whole lot, that got rid of them. We were then given derelict cars and used to tour about the country while we were getting mechanized lessons. One thing to remember, cavalrymen with horses are always very fit from grooming and riding. And when we took to cars, the fellows were very fit and found they had plenty of spare time and really worked very long hours. It was noticeable sometime afterwards that the men weren't as fit as they were in our horse days.
So would you say that playing polo and things like that, in fact, was a sort of...
Only the officers played polo. Riding and grooming. Grooming is a very severe exercise. To groom a horse for half an hour, you're pretty well done, unless you're very fit.
So for the sort of other ranks and things...
They mostly groom 2 or 3 horses every day at midday stables, and gave them a brush over again at evening stables.
So it was mainly them who felt or suffered from this lack of exercise later?
Well, it didn't come to suffering, but they were terribly fit when we first went into cars, and we used to work very long hours.
On your individual program, training program, when you've got the cars, and eventually the light tanks, how did you go about your sort of daily morning? How did you sort of break that up? How was it organized?
Oh, we had reveille, breakfast, and then parade at 9 as the normal thing, unless there were schemes and things. And unless we were doing what they nowadays call adventure episodes. I'm amazed by my regiment nowadays. Some of them have just motored from Germany to Afghanistan to go over the ground that the 4th Hussars had fought on in 1850-something. We, in our way, in those days, people didn't go into the desert much before we got these Ford V8 cars, and the Egyptians themselves were terrified of the desert. And there were no desert roads. While we were out there, the road was made from Cairo to Alexandria through the desert, and the road was made from Cairo to Suez through the desert. There were no roads in the early days, in the 20s.
But by the time you were out there and you've got the cars, did you start then to go out in the desert much further?
Oh, yes. Oh, much further. And we went in these derelict cars and were forever breaking down. It much increased the men's mechanical knowledge. And then after a time, we got brand new Ford V8s.
What was the main mechanical things that were happening that was going wrong?
Oh, dust in the mechanism, tire trouble, water boiling out. Because remember, they weren't new cars, they were derelict cars that had been bought off the roads.
When you've got dust, for example, and things like that, did you do on-the-spot repairs yourself?
Oh, always. We were out in the desert. There was nothing near us. But if it was particularly bad and a car got crashed, then we had to send out a special wagon. But ordinarily, the whole idea of improving the mechanization was to have these breakdowns to let fellows overcome them. And of course, another great desert trouble, especially with cars with narrow tires, was learning what the different sorts of sand looked like, which you could go on and which was the equivalent of a bog, which needed very high training, both in the desert and in Europe.
Did you receive training from the 11th Hussars to get yourself out of that sort of trouble, or did you sort of develop
At all ranks, 11th Hussar officers helped us, and 11th Hussar other ranks did most of the lecturing. And they were a very good regiment who gave us very great help.
But in specific things like getting yourselves out of trouble in the sand when you got bogged down?
The chaps were pretty good with cars and knew a fair amount about mechanisation. It was the others, up to a point, largely common sense.
Were there any special sort of techniques you developed?
Oh, yes. You either dug the sand out, or what you normally did, you got a sort of track, a metal track, which you put under the wheels, which is about 15 foot long, and you put them under the wheels each side and got the car started. Once it started, it would move over soft sand that wouldn't hold it when it was stationary. But we normally dug ourselves out. It would be exceptional for any breakdown vehicle to have to go out and pick a car up.
Now, how many of you, when you mentioned the car, how many of you were there in the car?
Four people in each car. When we got the Ford V8s, we had four people in the car, one machine gun, 3 days' rations, and 300 miles of petrol. And that was our limits.
And were your roles in the car sort of interchangeable? Could you do everything?
Oh, yes. Everybody had to interchange. Fire the machine gun, drive the car.
You mentioned a bit earlier on that you did schemes. What sort of things were you doing when you...
Oh, surprising people, getting over various types of country, advancing schemes in which you put out a fire point and then moved round to a flank, or retiring schemes which were the opposite. You put out a firing point and then withdrew round it and took up another position behind. That was what we'd done with the horse days.
Did you take part in sort of larger exercises with other regiments?
I don't remember any in Egypt. Now and then we did. We went out, I remember, to see the Royal Horse Artillery firing, and we went out once or twice with infantry. But infantry on their feet compared to cavalry was so different in speed that we weren't in the same class. And it was later that infantry regiments were mechanized and used to come round and help make our strong points stronger.
So you do recall specific instances where you were in the cars and you were alongside infantrymen and finding that they were lagging behind?
No, our role was different. We were getting the information at the distance to give them warning in time. Or we could go and seize a point while they were coming up, was a thing that we did in cavalry days and in the car days.
Did then having the cars make... You'd be much quicker at doing that, wouldn't you, with a car? Rather than...
Oh, much quicker. Oh, yes. Our life became very much more easy. In the olden days, you'd been out on a scheme all day on a horse, and to get in pretty tired and then groom it and feed it and everything else, which we always did before we did anything else, it was far easier just to slam a car in the garage and go home.
So in that sense, mechanization was quite popular?
I don't think so. We were all young men and fit. and we did our job. I don't think it was any less popular because of getting vehicles for horses.
You mentioned the other ranks just now. How did they cope with this change that took place from horses to mechanization?
I don't think they had any trouble at all. The tactics was much the same. All our signal orders were the same. To mount, to move off, to change direction, to take up formation was all done in the cavalry by signal. In fact, once we had an infantry officer attached to us on one of the schemes in the desert, and I took him and my second in command to hear the orders. On the way back, I signaled to the people to mount. I then signaled the direction to move off and the direction to go and the formation. And this infantry officer was quite shocked and said, "But look, you haven't told them what the scheme is yet." I said, "We don't need to. We go there to fight."
What I was thinking of then, and I said difficulties, was actually working on the maintenance of the car, for example.
No, they were very interested. And I think young chaps of those age are always interested in mechanization. And we found it time and again, young men all go for motoring jobs. They like the sitting, they like the mechanization.
What about the older sergeant majors and RSMs and people? How do they...
They took to it very well. It was rather speedier action. But they were all very good chaps, and they weren't all that old. Most men joined the services about 18. By 38, they'd done 20 years, and 21 years, very few people did. Most people only did 12. They left at 30. They had a young man's outlook.
Did any of the ORs... go to Bovington at all? Were there any
particular... Oh, yes. Other ranks went to Bovington. They were all keen to learn mechanization. They looked on it as a very good job when they went back to civilian life.
Did you, while you were out in the desert, go on any long-distance trips?
Oh, yes. I was very keen on this myself. I used to take the squadron out in the early days, in the winter, to a spring, a hot spring called Sukhna, which was about 100 miles south of Suez on the Red Sea, and we always went a different route there and a different route back through the desert to get to know the different types of desert. In 1937, I had read about one of the oases in the western desert called Farafra. And we made tremendous arrangements to go to this place, which was a very long way off. Unfortunately, at the last minute, General Hobart insisted that we should go and reconnoiter the Alamein line, which from the south, which I did late on in 1937. And remember very well the features there. I often used to sleep under Gabel Hamaimat, which was a big lump of rock sticking out of the desert, twin lumps of rock sticking out of the desert, and often slept under there. And many years later, when General Montgomery was going back to see his old battlefields, as I live not too far from him, I wrote to say I had my old maps and some photographs, and I was very interested when the Germans captured Gabel Hamaimat because I knew it outflanked his Alamein position. And I said that I'd be very interested if he would take a photograph of it when he was out there. My wife. On General Montgomery's return, he sent me a copy of the photograph that I had asked for, with himself in the picture, and a full-page letter describing his action there. And he was very interesting about it in the war, that he wanted Rommel to stay there, although it was between his position at El Alamein and Cairo. He knew that Rommel hadn't enough petrol to cut over to Cairo, and Montgomery was sitting on Rommel's line of communication to the west and made things very difficult for him. So he left him there, I think it was for nearly a week, wearing out his men and vehicles, and eventually gave him a good hit.
Were there any other places that you went to on these trips?
Not that I remember, other than reconnoitering the Katara Depression, which, as you know, is about 40 miles south of the Mediterranean and is a huge deep place which can't be crossed by anything of any weight. And we used to go and try and find out if we could find any paths across it, which we never did, in fact.
When you went on those trips, did you have to put in a report? I mean, what was done with the sort of...
No. It was just training. You got permission from your colonel, who got permission from the brigade, and you went out for 3, 4, or 5 days.
And you wouldn't have to report in anywhere, or you couldn't?
Not other than the time I went to the El Alamein line. Other people were doing it all the time.
At what stage, then, was it that you saw the need of a sun compass?
Well, the Italians were starting to fight in Abyssinia, and many people in 1936, late 1936, early 37, hadn't been out in the desert much, and so the brigade arranged for Colonel Morrow Kavner, who was the colonel of the 11th Hussars, to take 2 officers from each regiment, go to Sidi Barani, where we were taken deep in the desert by a sheikh. We again were in open cars, not specially built for the desert, and I was with Charlie Duff, an officer in my regiment, and I said, I'm not very happy about a sheikh leading us, thinking in camel pace, with us going at car pace. I said, after an hour we'll have done what he did in the first day, and by about 3 hours, he will say he's lost. So I'm going to keep a rough check, which I did with the compass. And eventually we stopped for lunch, we went on again, and then we stopped again, and Colonel Kavner said, the sheikh says he's lost, it's there. Well, all we could see was a flat plain with camel thorn on it, and there was nothing to see at all. So the colonel said that we better cut straight back north and hit the Mediterranean again, without the help of the sheikh. And I said that I rather suspected that the sheikh might get into difficulties, and I kept a rough check. If he'd leave me a minute, I'd draw in on the map the directions we'd be going in and the distances that I'd checked, and I found that we were about 15 kilometers out on a bearing of 225, which I remember to this day. And they had a bit of discussion as to whether we should do this. And I said, well, 15 kilometers we'll do in about 3/4 of an hour, but certainly under an hour. And then we can see. While I was working it out on the map, the sheikh came and looked at me and kept wagging his head. I wasn't able to talk to him. And so we set off with me leading. And I stopped as the sheikh did and said, look, it should be here. And so they got the sheikh out and said, it's here. And he looked around for a bit and he found it. We were within about 300 yards. From then on, he was frightfully interested in the map and the compass. And we were supposed then to go due east and hit another well of a sort. This one was called Bir Hamsa. And the colonel debated as to whether we should do that or go back to the coast. And I suggested we should do it. We had quite a bit of difficulty, and I led the way. And after this, I realized it was so difficult to leave your car with a running engine, with an ordinary prismatic compass, take your line where it was absolutely flat and mark it on a bush, which there were thousands of others. By the time you got back 20 yards to your car, you had great difficulty in showing your driver where to drive. However, this is what caused our trouble, and we actually had to spend the night in the desert, just camped down where we were, but we were ready for it. And from this I realized two things. One, that we really needed something better than that, and secondly, that at 12 o'clock the sun is in the south, and therefore if you have a vertical pencil, the shadow would be in the north. So at an hour before that, you could calculate where it was, and so we worked this out. And from that, we did the sun compass. But the difficult thing was, having finished with it on paper, to turn it into something which could be used in the field and not be destroyed all the time. A paper or thick cardboard or something in the sun and wind and dryness of the desert always warped. And the ordnance people who I went to were very good and worked out a scheme in which they photographed it onto a bit of metal and then burnt it in with acid.
So when you've got to that stage where you've got a metal one, you fitted it to your own car, did you?
Oh yes, and used it. And I have some papers there in which another man who was actually Royal Signals, and his name was Hopper, had produced a compass. And I got some papers from GHQ saying that they'd been given two sun compasses, and they wanted the ordnance to try out these two compasses to see which was the better. And as soon as I heard this, I wrote to the ordnance and said, I got a copy of the letter and said that I wanted my one tested by an eighth czar. And so they said, right, well, the eighth czars will test one and the 11th czars will test the other. But when the actual day came, there was a Lieutenant Dobby in the Royal Engineers who said that these sun compasses were ridiculous. He could be just as fast with an ordinary prismatic compass. So I suggested that we three should meet and do a test round a five-sided course with each distance between 5 and 15 miles and see who got in first. Well, we did this test and I got in hours before anybody else, and my compass was adopted.
And once, I mean, who took that kind of decision to adopt it?
GHQ, it's all in there. The GHQ asked ordnance to say which was the better, and if they were both equally good, to decide how many of each should be made. But as far as I know, only mine were made.
Once that had happened, what was the stage taken then? Did you...
I ran courses on map reading and for officers from all regiments immediately before the war. It was organized by the brigade, and I used to go to other regiments and give them demonstrations, and eventually we had people in the regiment who also could go off and give demonstrations how to work it.
Did you invent any other compass or any other invention?
I invented... This one was for latitude 30, which was covered all... and 2 degrees either side of it, which covered all the western desert area. But we also... They were talking about doing one for the Sudan, and we did one for latitude 15 degrees north, which made a very funny... a time plate, because the sun went overhead for some months and went back to the south of you for other months, whereas on latitude 30 the sun was always to the south of you, so it made the time plate much less complicated.
And you actually devised another...
Yes, I devised another one in a half moon shape, which never fructified because the first one was so successful.
You mentioned earlier on that you come across General Hobart. What did you have very much to do with him?
Not in Egypt. I don't know what he was doing. I think he must have been on some special staff. But later, when I was back in England in 1941, he was in command of the 11th Armored Division, and I was sent as a regular officer to help reform a yeomanry regiment, the 1st Lothian Border Horse, who had lost a great number of men and officers when they were evacuated from France.
Think of Hobart?
Oh, he was a tremendous man. And he had a tremendous drive, and he did everything with maps. He thought up endless project graphs showing how many men you trained, what standard they got to training in guns and wireless and other subjects, and how the vehicles were arriving, and he was a tremendous man, and it really was a great help, all these graphs of exactly where you were getting to. It helped you form it in writing your programs and things. And he was always thinking up new ideas. And then, of course, when we actually landed in Normandy, he was in charge of a division which they call the Funnies, the ones that thrash the ground to explode landmines, flamethrowers, ones that could grow on land and water, and he commanded in...